The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Well, I'm flying solo in the radio booth today, no producer, so hopefully nothing goes wrong. We've got our staff kind of spread all over the world right now. Mr. Flurry is in Normandy for the 75th anniversary celebrations of, or commemorations of D-Day. Sam, our regular producer, he's over in the States. Bradley is now graduated and gone back to Australia. So, thin on the ground. So hopefully nothing goes wrong. Well, like I said, it is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And Mr. Flurry and crew, they were in Portsmouth yesterday for all the events going on there, along with the Queen, with Donald Trump, with the Prime Minister. I believe the plan is he's going to kind of record some video or some audio diaries and some interviews and some of his impressions and experiences. And you should be able to hear from him on tomorrow's show. So you can be sure to tune in for that. But today, because it is that big anniversary, I want to spend the whole show focusing on D-Day. I thought of getting into some other material, but there is a lot to talk about. Some very important lessons from D-Day, and I think it really is worth spending the whole show on it. So I'm going to go over some of the history, and I think one of the really important things to remember is, well, when we look back at history, it's so easy to think, well, the way things happened in history is the way it had to happen. And we can end up looking at history as just this unfolding of inevitable events. The Allies won World War II because they were always destined to win World War II. The Allies won D-Day because they were always destined to win D-Day. And like we've talked about a bit on some of these other shows on history, that is very much in keeping with the way history is taught today. Mr. Flurry, I think, has drawn attention to that quote from, I think it was George Will, about how it's taught as this an unfolding of inevitability and vast impersonal forces. I guess Isaiah Berlin, I think, coined the vast impersonal forces phrase. But anyway, the point is that we tend to look at it as, well, yeah, it had to happen this way. And when you look back at D-Day, I think it's crucial to understand that that is not the case. It did not have to happen this way. One of my... things are already going a little wrong because I don't have that book with me. I might have put it down. But one of my favorite books on World War II history is Andrew Roberts' book, The Storm of War. And part of the reason why I like that book is it makes it very clear that the Allies could have lost that war. Now, he points to a few things that could have gone differently. That had they gone differently, the Axis would have won. Had the Axis powers, had Hitler done a different thing here or a different thing there, they could have won the war. And I think he makes a very convincing case that a few of those points, things could have gone very differently. And D-Day is one of those points. I think it was one of the riskiest operations that the Allies took in the whole war. You know, amphibious operations as a whole are hugely risky. You're attacking entrenched defenders, and those of you doing the attacking, you're out in the open, you're on the seas, you're on the beaches. All the shipping and boats and landing craft are all clustered together in a small target, which is just perfect for submarines or for aeroplanes to attack. And so far in World War II, amphibious operations hadn't had a great track record. In The Storm of War, Andrew Roberts wrote, "Amphibious operations had not had a rosy history in the Second World War so far, let alone earlier. The 1940 attempted landing at Dakar and the 1942 attack at Dieppe had been disasters. Salerno and Anzio had been near disasters. Torch had been extremely lucky with the tides and anyway had not been undertaken against the Germans. Further back, Gallipoli haunted the minds of many, not least its prime author, Churchill. And when you look at what some of the planners around there were saying, as we will do in a moment, it doesn't really fill you with confidence. And you look at what Hitler was doing to prepare for D-Day. Well, no wonder. You know, he'd had 2 million slave workers working for 2 years to create these huge German fortifications in France, the so-called Atlantic Wall. 18 million tons of concrete had been used to create bunkers and fortifications. Mines were laid all over the beaches and the waters. Poles were driven into the fields to stop gliders landing. Alan Brooke, the supreme commander of the Imperial, or the commander-in-chief of the Imperial General Staff, he wrote in his diary on June 5th, the evening before the invasion, "I am very uneasy about the whole operation. At the best, it will fall so very, very short of the expectations of the bulk of the people, namely all those who know nothing of its difficulties. At the worst, it may be the most ghastly disaster of the whole war. I wish it was safely over." Even Eisenhower remarked to his staff, "I hope to God I know what I'm doing." And some of the events in the run-up to D-Day had been less than promising. 2 big dress rehearsals, Operation Tiger. A couple of big dress rehearsals, one of which was Operation Tiger, had not gone very well. So Tiger was a dress rehearsal for D-Day on the British coast, where they'd get all the troops together and practice landing on beaches to run through it all. Well, what happened was a group of German torpedo boats found their way into the landing ships. And nearly 1,000 people died as these transport ships were sunk. And the Allies were so worried about the morale effect of what happened here that they hushed it up for about 40 years. Then after that, there was Operation Eagle, which was a dress rehearsal for the paratroopers and their part of the landing. And that also went pretty badly. One group of paratroopers or planes ran into a German bombing raid, and then they scattered and they couldn't find the drop zone. Paratroopers got dropped all over the place. 28 planes ended up returning to base without dropping off anyone. There were 500 broken bones, sprains, or other injuries. Stephen Ambrose, in his book Band of Brothers, it's the book that the famous TV series is based on, and a really great book, by the way, but he wrote, "The only consolation for the airborne commanders could find in this mess was that by tradition, a bad dress rehearsal leads to a great opening night." So that's what they had there, another bad dress rehearsal. So you can see why people were nervous the night before D-Day. It could well have failed. And think about the consequences of a failure of D-Day for a minute. You know, the Allies had spent years preparing D-Day. There's construction on 2 artificial harbors, for example, that began a couple of years before. It took years to build up all of those landing craft. If they'd been thrown back or defeated, well, they would have been done for. They could not have been another Allied landing that year. They may not have been able to come back until 1946 or 1947, which means, you know, you're prolonging the war into 1947, 1948. And it could have well meant the loss of the war. You could have had a situation where if there was some big debacle or failure with the D-Day landings, well, Winston Churchill could have been pushed out of office. And then could a democracy have survived a World War II that lasted that long? That lasted into 1947, 1948. Britain would have been in total war for getting on to 10 years at that point. Andrew Roberts, he wrote, this was in a Telegraph article, he wrote, "The stakes could hardly have been higher. If D-Day had failed, it would have postponed the liberation of Western Europe by at least a year, perhaps longer. With the Germans developing new weaponry such as 1-ton warhead rockets, refuelable U-boats, advanced underwater mines, and jet aircraft, the war could have dragged on far longer, especially if large numbers of Wehrmacht troops had been redeployed to the east to fight the oncoming Red Army. Equally, if the Russians had destroyed the Germans' army there, nothing could have prevented the whole of Western Europe, perhaps even as far as Paris, falling to Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union." So even if Hitler had ended up losing to Russia, well, you would have had a Europe conquered by the Soviet Union instead of Nazi Germany, which was not really much of an improvement. George Friedman, he had an article this week looking at it from another direction. Again, basically arguing that if D-Day had failed, well, that Stalin would have probably made a separate peace with Hitler. And again, another way the war could have been lost with the failure of D-Day. Hitler just being left in control of all of Europe. Andrew Roberts talks about how the fact that with a loss at D-Day, America would have probably switched to a Pacific first policy. And again, you've got now potentially years for Hitler to continue to dig in and to continue to work on his various different advanced weapons projects. So D-Day could have been a spectacular failure. It could have been the end of the war. It's a very real possibility that today we could have been looking over a world split between tyrants, and we could be looking back on today as kind of the day hope died. The day Britain, America, Canada, the other allied nations tried to launch an invasion onto Western Europe and failed, and then went on to accept defeat. And it did end up being a close-run thing. Omaha Beach was one of the worst initially, at least for soldiers to get up on. There were cliffs there, unlike a lot of the other beaches. But the Allied war planners saw, well, they had to have Omaha because it was in the middle of between the other beaches. You had Utah Beach on one side, and then you had the British and Canadian beaches on the other. And things went so badly there that Omaha Bradley briefly considered calling off the attack, at least according to one report. But it didn't fail. I did have an account from that book that I think I left on my desk, but I might be able to get someone to fetch that later. So I might read it to you later in the show. But why didn't it fail? It could have done. Well, partly was the courage and the leadership of a whole lot of people willing to die for their country, people willing to take off into just extreme hazards, charge up into machine gun fire, especially those in the early waves. They would just have to jump out of the boat knowing that they were probably going to die. But what I want to focus on today is God's hand in D-Day. Because that's also something that played a massive role. Something played an even bigger role. Something that decided the battle that day. And Mr. Andrew Loker, his program yesterday is a great companion to this, or on a similar subject. He didn't talk about D-Day, but he talked about God's hand in world events. He went through what the Bible says about exactly that. I'll just play a clip. This is from the BBC Home Service, just at the announcing the D-Day invasion. I think it's really interesting just to hear the announcement. But also, it in there reads out Eisenhower's order of the day. But this is the BBC Home Service announcing that attack.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snag. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. The first official news came just after 9:30, when Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, usually called SHAFE from its initials, issued communique number 1. This said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces supported by strong air forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. It is announced a little later that General Montgomery is in command of the army group carrying out the assault. This army group includes British, Canadian, and United States forces. The Allied Commander-in-Chief, General Eisenhower, has issued an order of the day addressed to each individual of the Allied Expeditionary Force. In it, he said, "Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking."
So that was General Eisenhower there on what the Allies had to face, and then telling his troops, beseech the help of God. I'm just going to back up slightly because I have my book now and just give you a taste of what they were facing on some of those attacks on D-Day. This is a quote from the official account from Able Company of the 116th Infantry of the 26th Division after its landing craft hit Omaha Beach. And this was one of the, well, this was at 6:36 in the morning. So the early waves of the assault. Said ramps are dropping along the boat lines and the men jump off in water anywhere from waist deep to higher than a man's head. This is the signal awaited by the Germans atop the bluff. Already pounded by mortars, the floundering line is instantly swept by crossing machine gun fire from both ends of the beach. The first men out are ripped apart before they can make 5 yards. Even the lightly wounded die by drowning, doomed by the waterlogging of their overloaded packs. Already the sea runs red. A few move safely through the bullet swarms to the beach, then find they cannot hold there. They return to the water to use it for body cover, faces turned upwards so that their nostrils are out of the water. They creep towards the land at the same rate as the tide. This is how most of the survivors make it. Within 7 minutes after the ramp drops, Able Company is inert and leaderless. So just 7 minutes and all the leaders are dead. People keep jumping out of the boats despite seeing what has happened on front of them. And they ended up being pinned down on that beach for nearly 7 hours. And it was only 1:30 p.m. in the afternoon that they were finally able to say that we're moving forwards. So it was it required massive bravery, but it was a massive operation. And as we heard from Eisenhower there, it's something that required God's help. And I think listening to some of these speeches is really interesting. It paints a picture really of a completely different country. Eisenhower, he called on obviously in his order of the day there for people to pray. But I'll play in just a second an excerpt from King George VI. On D-Day, the audio quality isn't the greatest, I guess it's 75 years old, but this is what, on this day, the King of England called on his people to do.
That we may be worthily matched with this new summons of destiny, I desire solemnly to call my people to prayer and dedication. We are not unmindful of our own shortcomings, past and present. We shall ask not that God may do our will, but that we may be enabled to do the will of God. And we dare to believe that God has used our nation and empire as an instrument for fulfilling his high purpose. I hope that throughout the present crisis of the liberation of Europe, there may be offered up earnest, continuous, and widespread prayer.
So that's the King of England there calling on the nation to pray. Mr. Stephen Fleury read that quote at the public appearance campaign in Cardiff over the weekend and made the point there. How different is that from today's leaders? How much have we traveled away from just this, even any kind of belief in or reliance on God as a nation? And even just his statement about, well, we trust that our empire is a force for good and for God's will. Where do you see anyone thinking or talking like that today? You don't see it. Not much, anyway. And then calling people to prayer. He talked about that for a fair bit of this speech. And again, because the audio quality is not too good, I'll just play one short clip from towards the end of that. Again, this is so King George on D-Day on his instructions to the nation.
At this historic moment, surely not one of us is too busy, too young, or too old to play a part in a nationwide, a worldwide vigil of prayer as the great crusade sets forth.
So all of us need to be engaged in a nationwide, a worldwide vigil of prayer. And can you imagine a modern leader giving that kind of speech today? We need to hold a vigil of prayer. We need to pray for our people, pray for success, and we trust that God is using our nation. The US president said the same thing. He gave a public prayer on June 6th, and I believe Mr. Trump quoted from this prayer yesterday. But I'll play again a clip. This is from his kind of public prayer before the nation.
Help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts.
So that was on the morning of June 6th. And Mr. Roosevelt was there going before the nation and saying, well, I want everybody to pray in the morning, to pray in the evening for our soldiers. And again, imagine that today, a president or a prime minister saying, you know, not just saying, may God bless us or something like that, but saying, no, I want everybody in our nation to pray in the morning for this, to pray in the evening for this, to keep that up, because we've got a long, hard road ahead of us and we're going to need God's help on every step of it. It really is interesting. I mean, for someone young like me who doesn't remember anything, you know, close to that time, it really is revealing to go back over some of those speeches and newspaper articles. I remember a few years ago getting quite deep into looking around some of the newspapers around D-Day, Dunkirk and the Dunkirk evacuation, and reading all of these British newspapers, the Times and the Telegraph and these major newspapers. And it was just so completely foreign and alien the way that they were talking, because it was so common in those newspapers then to be talking about a day of prayer, a day of thanksgiving, beseeching God's help, God's miracles, God respond. And this was the mainstream press. And it was just all over. It wasn't hard to find at all. Now, I think it's also interesting that by 1944, it was still in the mainstream press. We'll have some quotes, but it wasn't as common as it was around Dunkirk. Now, I think at that point was a real low point in the war for Britain. France had just fallen, and there was even a greater willingness to turn to God at that point than there was in 1944, where things overall were going better, where there wasn't an imminent invasion of the UK mainland. Yes, Germany was still very strong at that point, but that kind of imminent threat had gone. Britain wasn't standing alone against Germany anymore, and so the newspapers were less filled with talk of days of prayer and fasting and giving thanks to God. But it definitely was still there. And like I said, it's so different, so alien to our times. It's like reading, I mean, I don't recognize my own country reading some of those newspapers, because we're so secular today. We've changed so much. And despite, as I said, it maybe not being quite as prevalent, it was still very prevalent, people talking about needing God's help. Admiral Sir Bertram Ramsay, for example, he was the commander of all the naval forces for D-Day. And he wrote in his diary the night before, "We shall require all the help that God can give. I cannot believe that this will not be forthcoming." These men look to God for help. And did God respond? Well, I'll give you the words of General Eisenhower. He later said, "While there was nothing else in my life to prove the existence of an almighty and merciful God, the events of D-Day did it." That was enough. Just the events of D-Day proving God. Field Marshal Montgomery, such an historic march of events can seldom have taken place in such short a space of time. Let us say to each other, this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Britain, America, and Canada, these were the three main nations involved in D-Day, although there were many, many other nations involved. But, you know, back then we weren't perfect by any means, but at least we were nations that looked to God, that besought his help, that thanked him once we had it. We'll take a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll keep looking at this theme. I've got a really interesting article from The Telegraph called The Miracle of D-Day that we'll read a few quotes from and look at God's hand in some very important ways on that D-Day landing. This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, and we're talking today about D-Day. In 1947, The Telegraph published an article titled The Miracle of D-Day. It was by Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Morgan. He was the former head of basically the Anglo-American planning staff, COSAC, that put together the plans for D-Day. So this is a very important person for the planning of D-Day. This isn't somebody kind of tangential to what was going on and coming along afterwards. This was the man that did a lot of the heavy lifting, probably most of the heavy lifting in terms of planning out D-Day. HistoryNet called him one of World War II's forgotten heroes. So absolutely fundamental to this effort. And also, you know, if you thought there was anyone who would say, well, God wasn't involved in D-Day, it was all human effort and it was fantastic planning, that was responsible for our success. Well, you'd have thought that would be this guy. You know, he was the guy that did the planning. I mean, you would have thought just even humanly, he would have wanted to take credit for it. But instead, listen to what he wrote about D-Day. He wrote, "Miracles still happen. How many of them have we not seen enacted before our eyes in these past few years? There was Dunkirk and its flat, calm sea. Who planned that? We saw no way out, barring a miracle. Then came the miracle. 2 years later, the British and American military convoy was sailing in order to land in North Africa. All the enemy submarines were on the lookout. A breathtaking moment came when a U-boat caught sight of the tall ship of one convoy. The rest of the convoy was obscured by a squall that appeared to be traveling along with our ships, providing cover. The result was that the Nazi observer thought that what he saw was merely worthy of routine report. Then, just as General Patton was due to land on the Casablanca beaches, open to the full Atlantic swell, at the very moment it seemed inevitable, that the whole affair must be called off, the wind changed from onshore to offshore and let the small craft land successfully. There was surely more than human planning here too. Then was the miracle of D-Day in 1944 with a last-minute change in the weather. The history of other theatres of war tell of many similar happenings. So, yeah, here was the guy that did a lot of the planning during the war and on D-Day. And he said, you know, sure, we did the best that we could with the planning. But at the same time, you know, you can't plan for a change in the wind or for fog providing cover for ships. And he gave credit to God for helping with those events. Now, central to the story of D-Day was the weather. Everyone had very specific requirements about what they wanted. You know, they wanted calm seas for the landing vessels, but then the Air Force wanted cloud cover for the planes. The Chief Meteorological Officer, James Stagg, he had a tough job, but he was the one they'd all turn to with, should we launch D-Day on such and such a day, or should we cancel it because of the bad weather? Right, but he complained that once he put everybody's requirements together for what they said was the weather they wanted and they wanted to wait for D-Day, he said that I found that they might have to sit around for 120 to 150 years before they got the operation launched. That's how long it would take for them to get the perfect weather. Now, they didn't necessarily got exactly the perfect weather that they wanted, but what they got really seemed to be the perfect weather that they needed. They'd originally wanted to launch D-Day a day or two earlier, but then you had some really bad weather come in. They were hit by the windiest month in Normandy for 20 years, and things were looking really bad. They put a lot of effort into keeping D-Day secret. We'll talk about that in a minute. You know, they had to postpone it for more than a few days. Well, they'd have to bump it back a couple of weeks. And then you've got the challenge of, okay, well, we've successfully kept this massive operation secret so far, but then with everyone waiting around for a couple of weeks, how do we still keep that secret? There was every chance it could have gotten out. So they were in a bit of a fix once this wind came in. But then you got a calm day in the middle of that for June 6th. Things seemed headed to calm right down. And it all worked to the Allies' advantage in the end. The stormy weather helped convince the Axis that no invasion could happen, so they weren't on alert. And then this much calmer day, in the middle of the stormy weather, or after this stormy weather, allowed the Allied troops to go in there and land without having to put off the operation. The Times in 1944, they wrote, the German commanders were advised by their meteorological service that there could be no invasion in the period including June 6th because of continuous stormy weather. That is why D-Day forces landing during a brief break in the windiest month in Normandy, for at least 20 years found so many German troops without officers, and why other enemy coastal units were having exercises at the time of the landings. And there's that last-minute change in the weather that was mentioned in that Telegraph article. So you had that calm, and they're able to get landed on June 6th, while a lot of the Axis soldiers were gone. And this is something that used to get talked about on the D-Day commemorations, you know, God's role in D-Day. This is an article from June 5th, 1954. So this is from the Times newspaper coming into the occasion of the 10-year anniversary of D-Day. And this was, a lead article from the editors. And they write, this weekend, men and women in many lands are looking back with pride or tears or infinite thankfulness to God and their fellow man to one summer morning when a slender strip of coast changed hands after the greatest amphibious operation of all time. By parachute and glider, by landing craft and swimming tanks, the liberating armies poured back into France. The Allied air forces, with skill and gallantry, had already struck their blows. The Allied navies shepherded their cargoes and delivered their bombardments. So Overlord was safely launched, and many prayers were answered. So again, a newspaper back in 1954 saying, well, our prayers were answered. God answered our prayers on D-Day. And that's not a sentiment, really, I've seen. I haven't watched all of Mr. Trump's speeches, and I know he did quote the... did quote Theodore Roosevelt's prayer. If anyone is going to make that point, it's probably him. So maybe he has. Like I said, he was speaking for a while today, and I just saw a bit of that speech. But so far, I haven't really seen anybody making that point this year. But in 1954, the Times would do so in an editorial. Now, there were so many things that could have gone wrong with D-Day that didn't. It was preceded by Operations Fortitude North and Fortitude South, and the aim of these was to confuse the Axis powers about when and where the attack would take place. Andrew Roberts, in The Storm of War, he wrote that the two Fortitude operations constitute the most successful deception plan in the history of warfare. So they had that expert planning, and a lot of effort went into this, but you also see God's hand in making sure that this didn't get uncovered ahead of time. Now, they did put a lot of effort into this. They acted like they were going to land in the Pas-de-Calais, which is a much shorter sea crossing to get there. They had fake props, fake tanks and landing craft made by film studios, fake camps, all with all kinds of detail went into making it look like there was an army here under the command of General Patton, the First Army Group, or the First Army, ready to go and land in the Pas-de-Calais, and it was all fake. They had an army of dummy landing craft assembled in the Thames estuary. They had a fake General Montgomery travel to Gibraltar to try and convince the Axis powers that they were going to do something down there. And Andrew Roberts wrote, these many varied, sometimes convoluted, yet often brilliant schemes save tens of thousands of lives. But at the same time, keeping secret the largest amphibious attack in the history of the world, that's a pretty big challenge. One aspect, or one part of the heart of this, was Ultra. Ultra was the UK's breaking of the German code, the Enigma code, or the Enigma machines. And really, a lot of miracles went into Britain being able to break that code, and that had a huge impact on the war effort that, because it remained secret for about 30 years after the war, wasn't initially appreciated as much as it could have been, but that played a massive role, and breaking these codes helped Britain completely infiltrate Germany's secret service in the UK. They were then able to use that network to put false information back to Germany. Again, false, saying that they were planning to invade the Pas-de-Calais, so they got the German intelligence network thoroughly infiltrated and pointing to the wrong place for D-Day. And the Enigma decrypts, they allowed the Allies to know that their deception had been a success. That they had, that the Germans had taken the bait. The Ultra, or the Enigma decrypts, they also gave the Allies a complete picture of Germany's command structure in France, the headquarters, the communications networks, and that meant that the French resistance could destroy a lot of those communication systems, which really slowed down the Axis response after D-Day. But a lot of this did come close to being undone, and at least the element of surprise. The UK had arranged with the French resistance for a signal for when the landing was about to take place. So the French resistance fighters could know, okay, the British and Americans and Canadians and others, they're about to land. We can get ready to support them. And there was a line from a poem that was going to be broadcast over the BBC to signal the attack is about to happen. However, the Germans captured and tortured a resistance leader, and they knew the signal. They found out about this line. And so this line came at 11:15 p.m., on June 5th, and the Germans intercepted, it was on the BBC Home Service, the line of this poem was broadcast, and so they knew, okay, the landing's coming. So the night before, they knew that it was going to happen. The commander of the lead, or the leader of the German 15th Army in the Pas-de-Calais, he put his troops on alert. You know, he told them that they're coming, be ready. But somehow the message did not get past the 7th Army in Normandy. So the bit of the army that really needed that warning, the German army that needed that warning, well, they didn't get it. Somebody up the chain of command in Army Group B decided that there was no way the Allies would broadcast over the air that the invasion is about to start, so they decided it was probably misinformation, and they didn't pass the warning on. So Germany could have been ready for that, but they weren't. And there are other things that seemed to go wrong that ended up even just working to the Allies' advantage. The night before the landing, airborne troops took off to be parachuted in behind the beaches to support the landing. There's the British 6th Airborne, the US 82nd and 101st. And their job was just to get in there to cause chaos, to stop the Axis rushing reinforcements to the beaches, to take out gun emplacements, to help capture roads and bridges vital to get the Allies off the beaches as soon as possible so that they could just keep landing troops and not get bottled up on those beaches. And for the American airborne divisions especially, things went pretty badly wrong, or so it seemed. Pilots carrying the 101st got lost in cloud cover. Only the lead planes had navigational devices to help to guide them and hone them in on the drop zones where they're meant to be dropping off these paratroopers. So once they were scattered, as they did in the clouds, if the pilots, the ones that weren't the lead pilots, they just had to guess. If they couldn't see the lead planes, they had no kind of navigational equipment, really, to find where they were meant to be dropping off their paratroopers. So they just gave it their best guess. Stephen Ambrose described what happened in his book, Band of Brothers. But he writes that the pilots were supposed to slow down before turning on the green light. And the green light was the signal for the paratroopers to start jumping. And then he quotes one of the paratroopers saying that the pilots, here they were, thrust into the very jaws of this violence, and they'd never had 1 minute of combat experience. So they were absolutely terrified. So they started to get shot at by anti-aircraft defenses, and the pilots all panicked because they hadn't been in combat before. So going back to the book Band of Brothers, so they increased speed up to 150 miles per hour in many cases. And although they did not have the slightest idea where they were, except that it was somewhere over Normandy, they hit the green light. And many of the paratroopers ended up dying in these planes even before they got into combat, especially some of the leadership. And going back to Ambrose's book, he wrote, they jumped much too low from planes that were flying much too fast. They were carrying far too much equipment and using an untested technique that turned out to be a major mistake. A bit further down, simultaneously, they jumped out and then the prop blast tossed them this way and that. With all the extra weight and all the extra speed, when the chutes opened, the shock was more than they'd ever experienced. Jumping at 500 feet and even less, they hit the ground within seconds of opening the chute, so they hit hard. Yet many of them survived, and incredibly, the confusion worked to their advantage. Some of the men were up to 35 miles off target. But this is from Andrew Roberts' book. They wrote that in the practice of dropping dummy parachutists, had the added advantage of so confusing German intelligence that it estimated that 100,000 Allied troops had landed by air, more than four times the true number. So it ended up sowing confusion among the Germans and making it even harder for them to respond. And then you get to the sea invasion with all of the troops landing on those beaches. And that sea invasion was an absolutely massive effect, or a massive operation. And I think this is another overlooked area of God's hand in D-Day. D-Day was a triumph for the British, Canadian, and American soldiers. It was also a triumph for the Royal Navy, for the USAAF and the RAF. But it was also a victory of Allied and especially American manufacturing. There was just huge amounts went into this landing. 7,000 warships were involved, ships were involved. That was 1,200 warships and 4,000 landing craft, 11,500 aircraft, 2 million men, 154,000 alighting on French soil in just the first day. That's over 70,000 US troops and just over 80,000 British and Canadian forces. And that's, and then you start to look at all the logistics that go into supplying all of this. So, for example, there are 57 million square feet of storage area in the UK filled with supplies for D-Day. 57 million square feet. That's 2 square miles of storage area filled with supplies for this day. There was 500,000 tons of ammunition brought over from the US. 500,000 tons. Now, the Germans' intelligence, they assumed that getting all of this supplies to the troops ashore could only be done through a major port. And that's another reason why they didn't think the attack would take place in Normandy and ended up getting kind of caught off guard there. So to get around this, the Allies built 2 artificial harbors that would be shipped over the channel and then sunk on the beaches. It took 600,000 tons of concrete. That would have been enough to build over 2,000 houses. 1.5 million yards of steel. This is just into making these artificial dockyards that would be shipped over and used to supply the troops. 20,000 men working in 8 dry docks to put these together. Then there was also Operation Pluto, the pipeline under the ocean to build steel and lead pipes under the English Channel to send ultimately 172 million gallons of fuel under the channel. I think it was 80 mile or so. I didn't write it down, but a pretty good chunk, a good distance over to supply those troops there. And then there's the air battle and the bombing campaign that made D-Day possible. Air supremacy for the Allies was crucial. And Allied air dominance at this point of the war was, you know, it was huge. It was one of the big reasons why D-Day probably couldn't have happened any earlier. The Allies flew over 13,000, nearly 14,000 air sorties compared to the Luftwaffe's just over 300. So you had massive more Allied planes in the air, tons more. One naval commander, he described the scene out at sea. He wrote, it was almost like Piccadilly Circus. There were so many ships there. And it was incredible to us that all this could be going on without the Germans knowing anything about it. But we never saw a German aircraft the whole time. And that was just because the Allies dominated, absolutely dominated the air by this point in the war. Only about a dozen German fighter bombers made it to the D-Day beaches, and they could only stay long enough for about one attack each. Now, if you think of more planes making it through, if something like the German air superiority that they'd had earlier in the war, or even anything remotely close to equality, or even just the Axis being at only a minor disadvantage, it could have been carnage. You've got this massive concentration of men on a beach, this massive concentration of boats, the flower of the Royal Navy just sitting there. There could have been a huge amount of equipment and men destroyed there. But it didn't happen because the Allies ruled the air at this point. Erwin Rommel, he later described the Axis experience. He wrote that even the movement of the most minor formation on the battlefield, artillery going into position, tanks forming up, etc., is instantly attacked from the air with devastating effect. During the day, fighting troops and headquarters alike are forced to seek cover in wooded and close country in order to escape the constant pounding of the air. Up to 640 naval guns have been used. The effect is so immense that no operation of any kind is possible in an area commanded by this rapid-fire artillery, either by infantry or tanks. You know, earlier in the war, Germany had been known for their rapid-fire, blitzkrieg-style warfare, and now their tanks could only creep and crawl towards Normandy, partly because of the access of the actions of the French resistance, and partly because any open movements drew instant attack from above. Andrew Roberts wrote, D-Day once again saw a determined German counterattack on the ground being staved off by Allied air power. The capacity and willingness of the Wehrmacht to try and push the Allies back into the sea was still there, but was overwhelmed by the ability of the RAF and USAAF to attack the unprotected armor from above where it was weakest. The bombing campaign against the Luftwaffe factories and attritional war against German fighters once they had been built, had paid off spectacularly. And then there was the Battle of the Atlantic that had to be won. German submarines had to be kept away from the Navy that was out there in the Channel, supporting the invasion. Again, otherwise it would have been a disaster. And that required victory in submarine warfare. And again, that required cracking the German codes It required masses of new ships to be built. And it required a massive logistical operation then to get all the supplies and men safely across the Atlantic to the UK, ready for the invasion. And all of this was possible because of just largely American industry and a massive industrial dominance. Pearl Harbor obviously was a big loss for the US at the time. But once that industrial machine was cranked up, America made every 2 days the same number of planes that she lost at Pearl Harbor. You know, 2 days. In 1944, Germany built 40,000 aeroplanes and America made 100,000, more than double. And this massive manufacturing advantage really helped the Allies at D-Day. I'll read another bit from Andrew Roberts' book. When he writes, by the end of the war, the U.S. had built nearly 300,000 aircraft at a cost of $44 billion, 351 million metric tons of aircraft bombs, 88,000 landing craft, 12.5 million rifles, 86,333 tanks. Meanwhile, American shipyards had launched 147 aircraft carriers, 952 warships, displacing 14 million tons, no fewer than 5,200 merchant ships, totaling 39 million tons. The total munitions budget from May 1940 to July 1945 alone amounted to $180 billion, or 20 times the entire 1940 defense budget. Such was the United States' financial and economic commitment to victory, quite apart from the 14.9 million people she mobilized in her Army, Army Air Force, and Navy. Grossly to oversimplify the contributions made by the three leading members of the Grand Alliance in the Second World War, if Britain had provided the time and Russia the blood necessary to defeat the Axis, it was America that produced the weapons. I'm starting to run out of time here, but the point I want to get to is it took a superpower. And really it took, if you look at World War II, two superpowers. Britain as the declining empire, America as the rising superpower to defeat Nazi Germany. It took just this massive industrial capacity and massive amounts of raw materials went into this operation. And this was a blessing that was specifically promised from God. Let's get into some scriptures that I wanted to get into a little bit earlier, but we've still got a few minutes to look at them. And look at Deuteronomy chapter 33 if you have your Bible with you. And we'll look at some of the blessings God promised to, well, the descendants of Joseph, which, as you can prove in our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, is referring to Britain and America. But in Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 13, it says, and of Joseph he said, blessed of the eternal be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and of the deep that couch beneath, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the noon, of the chief things of the ancient mountains, and the precious things of the lasting hills. For the precious things of the earth, and the fullness thereof, and the goodwill of him that dwells in the bush, let the blessings come upon the head of Joseph. So, Mr. Armstrong, in that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, has a whole host of statistics showing how God answered that blessing, that prophecy. And about just all the amount of those precious things of the hills, all of these raw materials mined out of the earth that Britain and America had. You know, they were blessed with all of these massive amounts of raw materials that went into D-Day. And they were a blessing from God. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 12 again lists the blessings and the cursings. The blessings for our people for obedience, curses for disobedience. And so Deuteronomy chapter 28 is filled with talking about the different kinds of blessings. Verse 12 says, the Eternal shall open unto you his good treasure, the heaven to give the rain unto your land in his season, and to bless the works of your hand. And you shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. So blessed with raw materials, but also the works of your hand, your industry, your manufacturing, the things you go out and make. And then your finances as well. You shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. The finances necessary to finance and manufacture all of this. You can look in verse 8 as well. The Eternal commanded you blessings upon you in your storehouse and in all that you set your hand unto, and he shall bless you in the land which the Eternal your God shall give you. there's, you know, so many of these revolve around even, you know, just manufacturing and what Britain and America were able to produce. Verse 3, blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the field. Verse 6, blessed shall you be when you come in and blessed shall you be when you go out. Clark commentary notes, your way, thy way shall be prosperous, made prosperous before you. You shall have the divine blessings in all your labors. So the manufacturing was blessed. And then finally, if we look in verse 6 and 7, well, in verse 7, and the eternal shall cause your enemies that rise up against you to be smitten before your face. They shall come out of you one way and flee before you seven ways. Britain and America will be blessed with military success as well. And that's the point I really want to leave you with today. Britain and America won because of God's blessings. And these blessings were necessary for D-Day to be a success. Now, our nations back then were more God-fearing as well. That means they raised a generation of men that could face this kind of assault on the beaches of Normandy. And our nations turned to God for help, and they received miracles. And then in a lot of cases, they turned and thanked God for those miracles. But then look at us today. Those blessings that we once had are being removed. We don't look to God anymore. You know, that's not who we are today. And so God is sending curses. There are dark forces again rising in this world. And this time, you know, we're not going to be able to stop them. There won't be any more Normandy successes because we don't have the help and the backing from God that we had back there in D-Day. But you can look at these chapters and you can look at the end of Leviticus chapter 26, for example, and God says he is punishing us. But because he wants us to turn to him, he says he's not going to forsake us utterly. He has a plan for our people. That's why he saved us in World War II. And that's why he'll punish us, but won't wipe our people out in the future as well. So you can read much more about that plan, about what God is doing with our nations in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. I really urge you to go onto their website, thetrumpet.com, and get that book.